On this episode of Still Loading, Raymond Benson. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. I am your host, Josh Koval, and today on the show, this guest is pretty much as close to a match made in heaven for the topics of interest that I have. For many of you, you know I love the James Bond movies. I sadly have not read enough of the books. I'm actually reading through my first one right now. I know. And it's actually even worse considering my guest today, but I wanted to have him on because he is also a gigantic James Bond fan, and he has a lot more clout than I ever will. But besides that, being a James Bond fan, he is also one of the official James Bond authors, and he also spent 10 years working in the video game industry. So it's just these two worlds connected, collided, and I couldn't be happier with tonight's guest. So tonight I have Raymond Benson on the podcast. Raymond, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for agreeing to come on. It was just kind of like I found you somewhat recently, and I saw that you wrote the way I found you is that I was looking up the history of James Bond games. I was trying to find some new ones to try out. In fact, I think the first one I saw, there was a game from the UK called Shaken Not Stirred, but it only ever released in the UK. It never came out in the States, and it's on a computer that I can't even get. So there's no way for me to play it. But I saw you did some text adventures.
Specifically,
you did text adventure conversions of A View to a Kill and Goldfinger.
That's correct.
So I guess before I ask you specific questions about the games, let's start off with your history of Bond. How did you first get into James Bond? What was your first experience with the character?
Well, we're talking way back into the 1960s. I was 9 years old, and my father took me to see Goldfinger on the big screen when it was first released. So, I kind of started, pretty early on. And about 6 months later, the double bill re-release of Dr. No and From Russia With Love came out. So within 6 months, I saw the first three movies on the big screen, and that pretty much set me off as a fan, and I started actually reading the books at the same time. Even though they probably were a little over my head, I could get the gist of the stories.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I reread them later again and again. And then, a year later, Thunderball comes out. And so, the mid-60s was the Bond mania boom. So I was right there in the forefront, and I was getting all the toys and the merchandise and everything else. So I stayed a fan all that time. It was a big part of my childhood and beyond.
Did you have the From Russia With Love attaché case?
That I was unable to get. I wanted it, and I asked for it, but apparently at that Christmas it was sold out, and it was hard to get, actually. And so I got the knockoff, the I think it was called Secret Sam, the knockoff, and yeah, it wasn't as good. But I got a lot of the other stuff. I got a lot, all the Gilbert action figures and, the board games and the jigsaw puzzles and the trading cards. I have the whole set of the trading cards.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
I just love geeking out about that kind of stuff. I try to find any James Bond merch when I can. In fact, I remember listening to your interview with James Bond Radio and also reading up on some of your stuff. You eventually designed some tabletop games for James Bond, or wrote some of the wrote an add-on for one of the tabletop games, right?
Well, the James Bond role-playing game?
Yes.
I did one I did one of the adventures for it.
So
That was at the same time that I was doing the computer games.
Real quick, I'm going to jump back in the episode, but I just wanted to show you this. I actually have the On Her Majesty's Secret Service one.
Well, that's the basic set.
It's okay. I know wrote one for something different, but I know it wasn't this one. Which one did you write?
Well, see, that's the basic set. You have to have that to play any of them.
Okay.
Then there were modules that come out that were adventures that you play with that basic set. And mine was You Only Live Twice 2, Back of Beyond.
Was it like, did it take place after the events of You Only Live Twice?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So
it's a sequel to You Only Live Twice. And, you know, they did a You Only Live Twice one. So they would do, you know, titles like Goldfinger, you know, Live and Let Die, You Only Live Twice. And then they would do original ones like Goldfinger 2, you know, things like that. And this was in the 80s.
Yeah. So a lot of this, unfortunately, was before my time. I wish I could have experienced Bond in its heyday, because I remember even learning through a different podcast that, like, Sean Connery, towards the end of it, like, he was just, especially in You Only Live Twice, he was just getting mauled in Japan. Like, that was, like, when it seemed to be at a fever pitch, at least in pop culture.
Yeah, that's, he was, you know, I mean, by all accounts, he was, he felt he was underpaid, and he was, and this was at a time when, you know, paparazzi and everything, that kind of invasion of privacy was not a regular thing.
Yeah.
And so it took him by surprise, and he didn't like it.
I don't blame him. I wouldn't either.
And there were, I mean, he also wanted to do other things. He felt he was typecast, and the Bond movies were taking up too much of his time, and he just felt like, you know, that's enough after, you know, however it was, 5 years, 6 years of it. And he just said, that's enough. But then, of course, he came back for, you know, he came back twice.
They offered him, what, $1 million for Diamonds Are Forever, which
$1.25 million.
$1.25 million, which wasn't that more than the cost of the first movie?
Yeah.
It's crazy. And then obviously the non-canonical Never Say Never Again, which,
right.
Now, I don't know how much you know. Maybe you, I'd assume you know more about it than me. Do you know, like, I heard there was plans after Never Say Never Again came out, because of the whole rights issues with Kevin McClory and all that stuff, there was plans that there was going to be like a rival James Bond movie series.
Well, McClory wanted to do that. There was no way he could. I mean, he only had the rights to remake Thunderball, really, is all he had. So he was planning to, you know, try to make a series.
Just re-release
all based on
the same
Thunderball,
movie?
You know. you know, there were... you know, I was actually part of the court case in 1999.
What? You were? Really?
Well, I was hired as an expert witness.
Okay.
On the Eon side.
Okay.
So, So there was no way he was going to be able to do that. I mean, he had been threatening to do that since since the mid-70s.
Yeah.
And they threw him off until the early 80s when he was finally able to do Never Say Never Again, and kept trying, but finally, you know, finally he's gone, and Eon bought all the rights from his family, and that's how come they got to do Spectre.
Spectre back in 2015, yeah. Well, not back, like that was that long ago, but
it seems like it.
It feels like it. I've been waiting for No Time to Die Forever.
Yeah.
But no, so you got started, so that's how you first got into James Bond. And then I remember also seeing you were one of the first people to ever write like a nonfiction book about the James Bond movies. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it was about the whole phenomenon. It was about not only about the movies, but it was about the books and Ian Fleming's life and the history of Bond. At the time, this was in the early 80s. At the time, there were a couple of books just on the movies. There was a couple of biographies of Ian Fleming that were already out of print. Maybe a couple of books about the novels that were out of print. I wanted like a coffee table book that had everything. A biography of Ian Fleming, a history of the phenomenon, and analyses and critiques of all the books and all the movies, all in one big package.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did. And it was the James Bond Bedside Companion. That was published in 1984. First, and then an updated edition came out in 1988.
Okay. So how much did you like how much research did you have to end up going to do?
How much research did I do?
Yes. How much research did you end up having to do?
Well, I did a lot. It took me 3 years to write it.
In fact, I went
to England and I met members of Ian Fleming's family and his colleagues and a lot of people associated with Bond. And yeah, I did research at the Lilly Library where they have all of Fleming's manuscripts. And yeah, it took a while.
I believe it.
Yeah. And it was, you know, after going to England and meeting, you know, the business people, the people that run Ian Fleming Publications, which at the time was called Glidrose Publications.
Okay.
That's how, you know, I made the contacts that, you know, then 10 years later, I was asked to write the novels. So you were the first American to do that. Yeah, I was the first American. Yeah, they liked The Bedside Companion when it came out. So that kind of put me, I guess, in their target site.
That's so cool. I was saying beforehand that I haven't read enough of the books. I'm actually reading through Dr. No right now. Like, it's one of the things where I always talk about, I need to start reading more often than I do.
Well, you really should read the books in order, in the publication order, because they do follow an arc.
Sorry, I'm reading Casino Royale, not Dr. No.
Oh,
my bad.
Right.
I said Dr. No because of the first movie, but I am reading Casino Royale.
Okay. Yeah, and it's very different from the rest. I mean, it's very dark and serious, and the others are, they have a different feel to them.
Really? So there's a big tonal difference between Casino Royale and the rest?
Yes.
Good to know. Good to know. I had no idea. I actually, one second, where are you? I was at a convention a couple of years ago, and I have a large chunk of them.
Oh, right. Yeah, the Cigna books.
Yes, I don't have all of them. I don't have all of Fleming's books, but I have a large chunk of them. Casino Royale is downstairs because that's the one I take to work with me.
Right. Now, just be aware that a lot of the American editions have cuts and censorship and deletions.
It does say unabridged, complete and unabridged.
Well, that's unabridged from the original American edition.
Good to know.
The original American editions were somewhat altered.
Were they toned down compared to the British ones?
Yes, some of them, especially a couple of them. So, you know, if you buy more recent editions, you'll get the British editions, because the more recent, you know, editions of the books are the originals.
Good to know. I'm learning new stuff all the time. This is great. Yeah. So what my next question is then, how did that transition from writing your James Bond book, writing your nonfiction Bond, the bedside book, and transferring it over to getting into games like that? Because your first game that I see here, at least on the credits according to Wikipedia, which who knows how accurate that is you were a designer and writer for Stephen King's Myst, and then in the same year you also did A View to a Kill.
Yes, yeah, that was 1985.
Yes,
it was a year after the Bedside Companion. What happened was, see, at that time I was living in New York City. I was single, and I was into games, and I was a big fan of the Infocom text adventures, you know, Zork and that stuff.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and you know, those were like, you know, state of the art at the time. You know, PCs were just coming into the home. Mm-hmm. And what games there were no graphics really. They were all, you know, these kind of text adventures. So I was playing those, and I also was kind of playing Dungeons and Dragons and the tabletop role-playing games. And the James Bond role-playing game came out in 83. So I was playing that, and I got to know those guys, and they had asked me if I wanted to write one of the modules. So I was working on that. And I did have a literary agent because of the Bedside Companion. Mm-hmm. And he called me up one time and he said, there's this company in New York that are making these computer games, these text adventures computer games, and they're looking for a writer, and they have a license to do a couple of James Bond titles. And I thought, oh, you. And I went, oh, wow. So I met with those people.
Okay.
It was a company called Angelsoft. And they were developing a few of these sort of text adventures in the you know, basically kind of like the Infocom games. And they had a license for Stephen King's novella, The Mist. Mm-hmm. And they had the license to do A View to a Kill, which was the current movie
yep.
that was going to come out that year. And they had one for an earlier movie, which was Goldfinger. And so they hired me. And the first one I did was The Mist. That was the first one we worked on.
Okay.
And I had a great time. And I think that's the best one of all of those that I did. It was just, it really lent itself well to the text adventure format. Because, you know, it takes place, I don't know if you know the story or the movie that came
not
out.
Not too well, no. I haven't watched the movie or read it.
They did a movie of it in 2007. Mm-hmm. But most of the action takes place in a grocery store. And so, you know, you're trapped in a grocery store with all these monsters outside. And you have to figure out how to get out and how to escape and how to get a car and all this stuff. So that worked really well. Then I worked on A View to a Kill. And I was able to get a script before the movie came out. And we also saw the producer of the game and myself, we saw a rough cut of the film in New York.
Really?
They exhibited it to all the licensors, you know, all the people that were doing,
makes sense for continuity reasons, yeah. too.
Yeah. So, and it was before the music was even added. So, then I did that. And then after that was Goldfinger. And that was it. That was the three games I did for Angelsoft. And those came out in 85 and 86. And that role-playing game for Victory Games came out in 86 as well.
Okay. So all around the mid-80s was where you first got your start in the games industry.
Yes.
So what were some, besides, were there any other influences that you had besides Zork that kind that you used to put, or that you used for the games you developed for those first three?
I was also playing, let's see if I remember correctly, there was another company doing adventure games called Terrellium.
Okay.
I think that was the name. And they had, they did, they did a Fahrenheit 451 game. They did a Michael Crichton game called Amazon. They did an Arthur C. Clarke one called Rendezvous with Rama. There were a few others. And those were really good as well. And they had a little bit of graphics too, you know, very pixelated graphics.
Yeah.
So those were fun. I liked those a lot. But mostly I was playing, you know, all through the 80s, I was playing Infogom games. I was a big fan. And they were very challenging and fun. And I wish they were available somehow today on today's computers.
there's some ways that you can. You can get a thing. I mean, you'd have to look for. I'd have to do a little bit of digging. But if you look up DOSBox, you can get. It'll just let you play any of those games that ran on DOS. On this, essentially, it's just emulating that old operating system.
Right.
So you should be able to play that. In fact, your game, A View to a Kill, is up on the Internet Archive, and you can play on DOSBox.
Oh my, yeah.
So you can. I was actually tinkering around with it, playing through it a little bit, trying to figure out my way through Text Adventures. And Text Adventures, you have to have I don't want to say a knack for them, but you have to be determined because it's a lot of trial and error. You're trying to figure out like what the next, what the next command that the game wants you to input. And I was trying to find a manual for yours because, you know, I didn't have all the packaging that came with it, but because I don't know all the commands that I'm allowed to put into the parser. So I'm gonna be doing some digging with that. But I liked what I was playing. I didn't get past the part where you find 003's body, but I'm gonna keep on playing.
Well, I don't really remember it very much. That was a long time ago. That was 35 years ago. So.
But this is one of the reasons I'm glad that you've told me all that you have so far, just because I love, I was telling you off mic through via email that I'm a big fan of video game history. So learning kind of even just from what you remember of your time in the industry is just really fascinating to me, because even if I wasn't there to experience it at the time of its launch, it's something that I like to look back with appreciation. I consider myself somewhat of like a amateur video game historian. If I could actually be a historian, that'd be fantastic, but I don't think I'd ever make enough money doing video game history stuff. But I would love to. But no, so and that's why I wanted to have you on, because the fact that you worked on James Bond stuff, not just as an official author, but on some of the games, I thought was really cool. And then I saw with some of your other credits, you went from James Bond to you worked on a handful of other games, and you even wrote some music for some of it. I see that you did some of the Ultima games. Specifically, you were the head writer and story director for Ultima 7, The Blackgate.
I was indeed. After I worked on the Angelsoft 3 games, I was still in New York, and I was doing some other writing, doing some other things. I got married. I had a kid.
Congratulations, 30 years too late.
and I was teaching. I just was doing some other things. But then we left New York in 1990, and we moved to Austin, Texas.
Okay.
And I was looking in the want ads, and there was an ad for a game company that said, we're looking for writers. And I went, oh, I'll apply for that. And it turned out to be Origin, because they were based in Austin. Mm-hmm. And I got the job. So I became a writer and a designer for Origin Systems, just as they were starting to do Ultima 7.
That's so cool.
Of course, I worked for Richard Garriott, who was Lord British.
Lord British himself, yes.
Yeah, and I got to say, he's one of the true geniuses of the game industry. I mean, he's a legend. And we became friends, and I worked for him. And he made me head writer for Ultima 7, The Blackgate, which was a huge game.
Yeah.
By that time, which was the early 90s, the technology had increased, full. I mean, we still weren't into Windows yet. It was still DOS, but we had graphics now.
Yeah.
And artwork and, whereas the Angelsoft games that I worked for in 1985 and 86, there was a team of maybe four people. With Ultima 7, there was at least 30.
Even now, that's 30 would be a minuscule amount compared to what is in the game. It's insane.
Well, I know. It's like making a movie now.
Yeah,
I
mean, it's ballooned so much.
I know. Well, making a video game today is like making a movie. It's millions of dollars in cost and, personnel and everything. But, it cost over $1 million to make Ultima 7 mm-hmm. at the time. And I had a team of writers. I had four writers working under me. And I don't know if you've played Ultima 7, The Blackgate, but it's huge. And it's got all these characters and all these subplots. And we had to write dialogue for all these characters. And there's one big giant main plot that you have to solve the game. But then in all the little towns in Britannia, the location, there's subplots that you can solve as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So each writer was in charge of one of the subplots, and I was in charge of the overall plot. And that took, over a year to do. And it finally came out, spring of 1992?
Yes. The official release date, once again, according to Wikipedia, so I'd have to cross-reference that, but it says April 16th, 1992.
I wanted to say it was March, but, who am I to argue with Wikipedia?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of ways you could argue with Wikipedia. It's just such a quick reference for me. If I'm actually like trying to put out some stuff, I will cross-reference it beforehand. But since it's just easy for me to open up, I like to do that as a quick reference. Yeah. But no,
I'm pretty sure it was March, actually.
Okay. And it was also released for the Super Nintendo as well.
That was later.
Yes. Yeah. At least 2 years, but we'll see. Who knows, once again, with Wikipedia. What's one of the biggest differences in writing that you found in writing for a video game versus writing a novel?
Oh, there's a huge difference. I did more computer games. I worked for two or three other companies.
Oh, I plan on asking you about those. Okay. There's a couple based off of TV shows that I watched as a kid and movies that I watched as a kid.
Right. Yeah. I didn't get into the novels until after the computer games. So, we should probably keep it linear, and then we can get into the novels.
So then how about this? Is there any, when you were writing for Ultima, did any bit of the influences that you got from James Bond find its way into your writing for Ultima?
I would say so. I think the plot of Ultima 7 is very James Bondian, because the Avatar has to, there's this evil organization called the Fellowship. And, you know, they're kind of like Spectre.
Spectre.
You know? And the Guardian is this sort of supernatural being that's in charge. But they have, the Fellowship has a human guy in charge on you know, on Earth. So he was kind of like the Blofeld, really, I guess.
Okay.
And I guess you could say it was structured kind of like a Bond story. I don't know. Of course, it's more of the fantasy genre, but
yes.
You know, it starts with a murder mystery. You know, a murder mystery that, and that's just the tip of the iceberg where you find out, you know, the big plot underneath. And Bond stories are a lot like that. They start mm-hmm. with something small at the beginning, and then he discovers that there's something bigger underneath that.
It's one of those things where when I saw that you wrote the Ultima game, because it's one of the Ultima series is something that I haven't had a chance to play. I'll be honest. I've only been able to play a handful of your early Bond games, but I wanted to ask you about this nonetheless, because the Ultima series is one of the most important series. And like you said, Richard Garriott is a visionary. He is one of the greatest game designers of all time. So I had to at least ask you about it, even though I feel bad I don't have a frame of reference. I want to play it, though, based off the story, the outline that you just gave me. So I'm going to be probably trying to find a way to get that, to find an emulator.
That's available somehow to be
probably.
Able to.
Yeah. I mean, especially it's an Ultima game. I feel like it would have to be available almost anywhere. But so after Ultima, you did a couple more. You had Ultima Runes of Virtue, which you were the score co-composer on.
Yes.
So how did that transition?
I did a piece of music that was in Ultima 7, The Black Gate. They had a score composer, but I was, you know, I've been a composer since I was a kid.
Okay.
I was a piano player, and I worked in theater before I did the computer game, you know, back in the 70s and before I started writing anything. So I was known for doing music for theater and other stuff. So I was able to do one song, the love theme for Ultima 7, The Black Gate. And then, so they asked me to do more songs for this, I guess it was the Game Boy. It was a Game Boy game.
Really?
Yeah, that was what it was for. The original platform for Runes of Virtue was Game Boy.
Huh.
Yeah. So I did about, I think, six songs for that. But I was also starting to write I wasn't head writer, but I was one of the writers for Ultima 7 Part 2, mm-hmm. Serpent Isle. But I left Origin before that was even finished. You know, the Ultima 7, The Black Gate got a lot of acclaim and stuff. And so other game companies started trying to recruit me. So Microprose came calling, Microprose Software, and they hired me out of Origin. You know, they got me to leave Origin, and I left and moved my family to Hunt Valley, Maryland.
Okay, wow. New York to Texas to Maryland so far.
Yeah, I know. And yeah, we did three cross-country moves in 4 years.
Oh my God.
Yeah, the game industry's like that. And so, yeah, I started working for Microprose in sort of later 1992. And there I designed, they had a whole department now that were doing these role-playing adventure games that were more graphic-oriented, where the little guy's walking around and you control him. And I did one called Return of the Phantom. And this was a sequel, basically, to The Phantom of the Opera. And that was a lot of fun to do. And I think it's a great game. I don't know how well it did. I don't think it did very well, but
I mean, the thing with a lot of point and click adventures, at least in the modern zeitgeist, or in the zeitgeist today, at least, is a lot of them, with the exception of a lot of the LucasArts stuff and the ones, the Infocom ones, are like, unfortunately, lost to time. Like, I should say lost to time, but not a lot of people know about them. So that's, once again, one of the other reasons I wanted to talk to you, because there is games on here, like the next one on the list, but I don't want to jump ahead, so I'm just going to reference it. We can go back to Return of the Phantom, but you did Are You Afraid of the Dark, The Tale of Orfeo's.
Yeah, that was next. See, after Microprose, they had to lay off a third of their company, right after
that
game came out. It was they were having financial problems or something, so our whole division got canned. And so I did some freelance work. I did I wrote Dark Seed 2 for Cyber Dreams, and I was a freelancer at that time. I wrote it, and then I got hired by Viacom New Media in the Chicago area. So we moved to Chicago, and that's where we did Are You Afraid of the Dark? Yeah, that was late 93, and then that came out in fall of 94. So, yeah, Are You Afraid of the Dark, of course, was, you know, Viacom, they owned Paramount, and they owned Nickelodeon and mm-hmm. MTV and all that. So they were doing a lot of tie-in titles that were, you know, based on some of their properties. I know they did a Beavis and Butthead game and things like that. So they did one on Are You Afraid of the Dark, which was a Nickelodeon, very popular show at the time. So I was the head writer and screenplay writer for that. And that was another big production. That was made in New York, and it was made in Universal Studios.
Oh, wow.
As well as Chicago. So, yeah, we were traveling all around, and that was a big game.
Was it harder to write for that because it was more geared towards kids? Did you feel like you had to change? Was it harder? Did you feel like you have to, like, I don't know if subdue is the right term, but kind of hold back a little bit more? Because in Ultima, that's a much more mature style of game. So yeah. I wasn't sure if you had to change for when you wrote for something that's more geared towards
kids. Not really. I don't think so. I mean, I had a kid at the time, a young kid. So I was well aware of children's books and stuff like that. So I think it just kind of came naturally. And, you know, I watched the show a few times, you know, some, and that wasn't a big deal. No. And that, you know, that game was very successful too. It won some awards. And then from there I did The Indian in the Cupboard, which was a tie-in to the movie that was a tie-in to the original book. And that, again, won some awards and things. And by that time, Dark Seed 2 came out. So, yes. And I still, I will say to this day, Dark Seed 2 is my favorite game that I ever did.
Really?
It's the best game I did. Yeah.
I'm going, you know what? Let me just see. Just because sometimes Steam will have it up on their store. They will have some games on there. That's not the right word that I'm trying to type. It's not on Steam. That's a bummer. I will hunt this down. Well, and
it is it. On. There's another company. Is it called GOG? Or?
Yeah, Good Old Games.
Yeah, GOG. You can get Return of the Phantom on there. Okay. I think Dark Seed 2 is on there.
Let's see what we got here.
Yeah, now the first Dark Seed came out the same time as Ultima 7 The Black Gate.
Okay.
And so I was hired to do the sequel. So, you know, I got to work with the artwork of H.R. Giger, you know, the guy that did the Alien stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a real, and I think I was highly influenced by Twin Peaks. And so it's a very David Lynchian kind of story. No, I really like Dark Seed too. I think it was challenging and a fun story to write. Yeah.
What was something that was unexpectedly difficult during your time in game development that maybe surprised you that it was more difficult than you were expecting?
I think the most difficult part was the crunch time.
We still hear stuff like that today. I mean, unfortunately, it's still a problem in the industry.
Yeah. Well, at that time, it was a mainstay. You know, crunch time was like you had to accept it or else. You know, you got paid a salary. You weren't paid overtime. And if you got into crunch time, then you had to do it. Oof. And it was especially bad at Origin. There were people sleeping at the office. Guys had, you know, sleeping bags in their office, and they'd be working until after midnight. They'd have barbecues outside at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning, and then they'd sleep until 11 a.m. and then get up and start doing it all over again. My problem was that I was married and had a kid. I had to kind of keep normal hours. So, you know, I'd get there at 8 and start working, and everybody else in the building was asleep. And then I would try to leave at 5 or 6, and except when we were really on crunch time, and I'd have to stay longer.
Whew.
So I was kind of an, I was about at least 10 years older than most of the people that worked at Origin at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of different for me, I guess. I never kind of felt like I was part of that group.
I could see how that would be a little bit alienating, just that, because that would make, I can't speak. I could see how that would be really alienating. I mean, it's not the exact same experience. I'm going to keep this personal anecdote brief, but like, when I worked at one of my old jobs, I was a cashier at a grocery store. And at that point I hadn't found my full-time position. So I was like 24, 25, and I was still there. And all the other people who I was working with were high school kids. So I just felt so disconnected from everything. I mean, I got along with them. They were nice, but I definitely felt really odd being so much older than them.
Right. Now at MicroProse and at Viacom New Media, I felt more like I was in more of my age group.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So did you leave game design because of the offer you got to work on the James Bond novels, or was it a combination of like, this is burning me out and now I want, and I got this awesome gig?
No, I was still working at Viacom when I received a phone call out of the blue from the Ian Fleming people. This was in late 1995. And at that time, a guy named John Gardner was writing the Bond books. And he had been doing it for over a decade. And he had said, he had told them, I just don't want to do this anymore. And I had kept, since The Bedside Companion, I had kept in touch with the Fleming estate. And we were friends. And I would do little odd jobs for them, no pun intended. And the man who was the chairman of Ian Fleming Publications, who happened to have been Ian Fleming's literary agent at the time, he was in charge, and he asked me if I would be interested. And I said, yeah. And I kind of had to audition. I had to write an outline of a novel first on spec. And it had to be approved not only by them, but also by the British publisher and the American publisher.
Okay.
Then once that was approved, I had to write the first four chapters on spec, same approval process. And then I got the job. And so it was announced in March of 96, I think, is when it was, when they announced to the world that I was the next Bond author.
That's so cool.
Then, I stayed at Viacom for another year while I was writing the first book.
Oh, wow.
So I didn't know how it was going to turn out, you know. it could, you know, they might not accept it at the end, or who knows, you know. So I kept my job. But as it turned out, Viacom was having problems, and they folded the company in the summer of 1997. Which was, you know, right after I officially left. So after my first novel was published, which was 0-10, that was published in April of 97, I left, because they expanded my contract to write, you know, more novels. So I said, why am I, you know, I don't need this day job.
Yeah.
So I left, and then 3 months later the company folded. So.
So it worked out. It was perfect timing. It was meant to be. Out.
Yeah, I guess so.
And then, so you were the James Bond author up until Die Another Day. You're the last That's one right. I see on the list here is that you did a novelization of Die Another Day.
That's right. Yeah, I did it for 7 years. So I did 6 original novels and 3 movie novelizations.
And what was some of your favorite parts about doing the research for the James Bond novels? Like, what were some of the things you had to do for research?
Well, I traveled to all the locations, and that was, you know, that was exciting. I never thought I would go to Cyprus in my lifetime, but I did. I never thought I'd go to Morocco, but I did. So I would outline, you know, the stories first. First, I would kind of think, all right, what's a hot spot in the world that England would be concerned about? And then I would do a little research about the history of that hotspot and why England would be concerned about it. Okay. And that's how my plot would come about. And I'd write an outline first and get that approved. Then I would travel to those locations. And I'd basically walk in Bond's footsteps according to my outline. I'd go to where he needed to go. I'd stay in his hotels. I'd eat the food he would eat. And if I needed, you know, and the name James Bond opens a lot of doors. So if I needed to talk to, if I needed to talk to like the police department in Paris, I could do that because, you know, I had some clout.
James Bond carries clout.
Yeah. Yeah. There was one of the cool stories was in Japan. I had to get down into the Seikan Tunnel, which is the underground, underwater rail tunnel, passenger rail tunnel that connects the main island of Japan with the northern island of Japan, Hokkaido. And it goes underwater, a mile underwater, and it doesn't stop in between the islands. But in my story, the Bond is on the train and a bad guy's on there and he stops the train and gets off and Bond has to chase him through the tunnels down there. And I asked J.R. Rail, can I get down there and kind of see what it's like so I can accurately write about it? And nobody goes down there. You know, it's completely forbidden for anybody to go down there. But I was able to go down there. My guide and an entire entourage of official people took me down there. And the funny part about it is my guide and I needed to continue our journey up to the northern island, to Hokkaido. And so they arranged for the train to actually stop midway and pick us up. So you can imagine the faces on the Japanese passengers in the train.
What's as this the guy train doing? Stops
underwater, you know, where it's not supposed to, and the doors open, these two white guys come on. You know? Who are they?
So, I mean, if I was in their shoes, I'd be so terrified. Like, what if, like, is something happening? Is this gonna break? That's crazy.
Yeah,
that's so cool. Is James Bond fever still a thing in Japan? I mean, I know that's okay. I wasn't, because at the time that we were, that I referenced before, when Sean Connery was there, you know, that was like the mid 60s, so I wasn't sure how much of that would still be a holdover all these
James
years
Bond
later.
Fever is everywhere.
You're not wrong.
I mean, when you can just, when there are still, you know, debates about, you know, who's the best Bond and should, you know, Bond be played by, you know, a woman or a black guy or whatever, these things are still going on all the time, every day.
Yeah,
and
you're right.
Still waiting for the next movie, you know, that's been delayed for 2 years now.
I'm excited for it too.
Yeah, there's the interest in Bond has never waned.
I remember hearing on the James Bond radio, your favorite Bond is Connery, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's Connery and then there's everybody else. And but you know, I understand that for a lot of people it's who you saw first in the theaters.
Yeah. It's a lot of the nostalgia factor.
Yeah. And I understand that. But you know, anyone, if you really study the movies and watch them in chronological order and are serious about them, you can see that the real envelope pushing, the real innovation came in those first six movies.
Oh, 100%.
Everything that comes after those first, the 60s movies, is just capitalizing on what was done then and just trying to make them bigger and splashier and better. It doesn't mean that they are better, you know.
That's a fair point. I would say, this is my favorite Bond. It's not the best Bond. I want to make that very clear distinction. Is actually Pierce Brosnan, because he was my first one I saw. I'm younger, but like, you know, I go back and I watch his movies now and there's a little bit too much of a tonal issue that I see with, you know, trying to be serious and then added in some of Roger Moore's camp. I will say, like, rewatching Connery's Bonds, though, specifically Dr. No and From Russia With Love, I think are my favorite ones of his. From Russia With Love specifically, I think is my favorite one of his.
That is my favorite Bond movie.
It's so good.
Yeah. Well, you know, you read the books and they're not silly. You know, they are serious. So,
and they're nothing like the movies from what I hear.
Right. And, you know, I mean, we could talk about the different styles of the movies.
Yeah, whatever, I almost went down my rabbit hole with it. I like I said, I'm a giant James Bond fan, even though I have a lot more to go with reading all the books. Like I said, because I want to read through all of Gardner's books and then, of course, all of your books. And that's going to take a while because I'm a slow reader. But
well, you know, Pierce Brosnan was Bond when I was writing the books.
Mm-hmm.
So I have an affinity for him. And, you know, I novelized three of his movies. Mm-hmm. So I was very much in tune with his films. And my son is, you know, his first movie in the theater was GoldenEye. So
okay. Okay.
So he has an affinity toward the Brosnan films as well. No, I John Gardner did GoldenEye, and then I did the next three: Tomorrow Never Dies, World Is Not Enough, and Die Another Day.
Out of the Brosnans, I guess out of the ones that you wrote, which one of them was your favorite Brosnan movie?
I would say Tomorrow Never Dies.
Tomorrow Never Dies. Okay.
Yeah.
That one is there's a podcast I listen to called James Bonding. It's one of my favorites with Matt Gourley and Matt Myra, and that movie specifically is the one that they have the biggest contention on, because one of them loves it, the other one it's his least favorite Bond movie, just period. So it's interesting. It's funny to hear stuff. It's interesting for me to hear that. But any case, So you wrote all those James Bond books, and you haven't stayed away from the video game industry entirely. I see you do novelizations of some video game series as well, correct?
I did. I did two of the Tom Clancy Splinter Cell books, mm-hmm. the first two, and then I did two Metal Gear Solid books.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, I did... first two books of that series, and then I did a Hitman book based on the Hitman game, and I did one on there was a game that came out in 2011 that was supposed to be a big thing, and it wasn't. It was called Homefront.
Yes, I know what you're talking about.
It was created by John Milius, the film director and writer, and I collaborated with him on the novel that was based on the game. And I thought it was a great game. I thought it was a great novel, but for some reason it just didn't take off. Then I did, I did Dying Light. That's the last one I did. Dying Light, Nightmare Row. It was like a prequel to the Dying Light game.
That's crazy. So do the developers reach out to you first for this? Yeah. So this is just them reaching out to you? And okay, so when you did the Metal Gear Solid ones, did you ever speak with Hideo Kojima about it?
Well, we corresponded through, I mean, he doesn't speak English, so we corresponded through an interpreter, mm-hmm. and I guess he was a fan of my Bond books, and that's why I was originally on the short list of writers that he wanted to consider doing the books, and I forget, you know, that was over 10 years ago, so I can't remember exactly what happened, but I got the job.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I would basically communicate with a guy named Ryan, I'm blanking on his last name, but he was very high up in the organization in Konami, and he was like the right-hand guy to...
Yeah.
But he was an American working in Japan. Mm-hmm. So he was my liaison, and Kojima, read all my stuff, and or at least had it translated and read it also. You know, he approved everything.
Would there be anything, because just to kind of start wrapping stuff up, would there be anything, any games that you would want to work on now? Like, because point and click adventures, believe it or not, are making a comeback. Would, if you ever got a chance to, would you ever want to work on another point and click adventure or just another game in general?
You know, I feel like the technology has passed me by. I haven't actually worked on a game since the mid-90s. So, you know, that's that's 25 years.
Yeah, it'd be a steep learning curve to start off with anything when you're out of something for that long.
It really would. Now, if somebody wanted to hire me just to write the storyline, the dialogue and the characters and something like that, I'd be happy to do something like that. I wouldn't want to be in working with a game company on the day-to-day nuts and bolts development. That is just, that's a young man's job, and I really wouldn't want to do that. But, you know, if somebody wanted a story that they could take and run with, yeah, I'd be happy to do something like that.
That's awesome. Well, Raymond, thank you so much for joining me. I do have the last couple questions I have. Is there anything you would like to promote that you would like people to check out?
Well, you know, since Bond and everything, I've been doing my own novels, and as well as the tie-in novels that I've mentioned. My last, four novels, more than that, I have a five-book serial called The Black Stiletto, mm-hmm. That is very popular. It's done very well. It was actually almost a TV series. with ABC, but
Mila Kunis, I think, was trying to head spearhead that, right?
She was going to be executive producer. You know, like many Hollywood properties, it just kind of didn't happen. It was going to happen, yeah. And then it didn't. But we're still working on it. It still has a producer attached to it, and it's still in development, as they say. So The Black Stiletto is probably, I feel like it's my magnum opus of anything I've ever written. So I highly recommend that, especially if you like any kind of superhero or vigilante stories, The Black Stiletto. My last four books with a publisher called Skyhorse are thrillers with a social conscience. That would be The Secrets on Chicory Lane, In the Hush of the Night, and Blues in the Dark. And my most recent book is a ghost story. It's called Hotel Destiny.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and I'm working on other stuff now. And so, you know, check me out at RaymondBenson.com. That's where you can find me, or on Facebook. I'm sure you can find me on Facebook and Twitter.
And what's your Twitter handle?
Raymond Benson.
Raymond Benson.
Yep.
What would be like, I guess this question just popped in my head. What would be a dream project? Not the dream project, because I feel like that could be a loaded question, but is there a dream project that you would love to get to work on?
Wow. Well, you know, I'm a big Twin Peaks fan. I would love to do novels based on Twin Peaks, but I think that market is already, Mark Frost, the co-creator, did a couple of books on them. So I don't think that's going to happen. Yeah, I'd love to do that. But otherwise, just, you know, I'd love to see some of my books made into movies or a TV show. We all us writers hope for that, you know, and I guess, you know, hope springs eternal. So.
Didn't you not related to the books, but aren't you a kind of a bit of a movie buff as well, like a film historian?
Yeah.
Too.
Oh yeah, I am. I've taught film history on the college level for many years. There's a magazine called Cinema Retro, mm-hmm. that I write for, and I do reviews of new Blu-rays and DVDs that come out. So if you go to the cinemaretro.com website, you can find my reviews. Of course, I link to those through my Facebook page, and
I'll make sure to include links in the show notes as well.
Yeah. And I'm also a working musician. You know, I'm constantly uploading piano pieces and stuff like that. So I keep my hands, fingers, and toes in a lot of places.
You got a lot of stuff going on, man. I am always envious of people who can kind of balance all that. So Raymond, seriously, thank you so much for joining me for this episode of Still Loading. As for me, you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Still Loading Pod on all of them. If you want to reach out to me, you can contact me at stillloadingcontact@gmail.com or go to my website, stillloadingpodcast.com. If you want to support the show, you can do that in a number of ways. You can go to Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use and give it a 5-star rating and review. That helps the show to get exposure so more people can find it. And you can also check out the Patreon, patreon.com/stillloadingpod. Even just $1 a month will help grow the show. And the most important shout out that I have, it is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of children receiving inpatient care at hospitals. So if you want to check them out, go to bitbybitfoundation.org and consider donating. And that's all I got. So I know I've said it 1,000 times, but seriously, Raymond, thank you for joining me.
You're welcome.
And I will see you all next time.
Thank you.